Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is a great show today. We have a phenomenal guest. Like, all my guests are phenomenal, but we truly have a great guest today who's going to get into not only what the title says, which is PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, but we really delve into lots of different areas. So for anyone listening, I really hope you gain something today from listening. Because look, we live in our society, there's a lot of pressures, there's lots of messaging, and a lot of people out there are struggling with body image issues, disordered eating, and hearing lots of misinformation. So really excited to bring on our guest and just delve right into this conversation. So after sobbing in her boss's office 15 years ago, Julie Duffy Dillon, who is a registered dietitian and PCOS expert, taught her last diet. Once she learned about weight stigma and diet harm, she couldn't unsee it. Now, Julie helps people with PCOS confidently tackle health concerns moving forward without shame and blame. She teaches people how to burn their PCOS diet books while bringing clarity into their relationships with food and body. She has spoken at the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Food and Nutrition Conference and was featured dietitian for the reality show My Big Fat Fabulous Life. You can hear her on her own podcast, Find Your Food Voice, and learn about her services, including her PCOS Power Course and Community at julieduffydillon.com. All right. Well, Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Christina. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right. So we could talk about a million things, I think. But first, before we jump into a topic, I'm just wondering for people listening who don't know anything about you, if you would share maybe how you got here, how you got to this place in, you know, your career and your life, whatever you feel like sharing.
Well, it is a very twisted journey, I think, probably like everyone else who does this kind of work. But I am a registered dietitian, and I have been one for over 20 years. And I worked in probably every area of nutrition that you can work in. I found myself after about 2 or 3 years specializing in pediatrics, which opened up some interesting doors in diabetes. And one area in particular that I found myself working in was in pediatric endocrinology. So diabetes and all the other stuff that comes in endocrinology. And that's where I first worked with higher weight kids and their families. It took a few months for me to notice that, most kids, if they came back to a meeting, then their weight didn't go down, it usually went up or stayed the same. And so I was like, maybe I'm doing something wrong. And to give you like the expedited version, I basically realized that I have no training on how to help people with like behaviors and emotions and mood. So I went in and did a master's degree in mental health counseling too, thinking that I was now going to be able to help people lose weight. And that's when I discovered things like intuitive eating and really spent a good year of trying to figure out where I wanted to go next. And with that, I started to pursue working with people who are trying to recover from eating disorders and also people who are trying to recover from dieting, because I really just came to terms with like diets don't work for most people and I can't be a part of it anymore. So since then, I have also veered into working with people with PCOS because of my work with eating disorders. I found so many of my clients with eating disorders also had PCOS. And only thing that we had as dietitians to help them were tools to help people lose weight. And I was like, well, I know that harms everybody. So why would that work for PCOS? Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the pivot for me where I started to really get into working in non-diet nutrition and I'm really glad because I got to do some fun things with it. Like I was able to be on a reality TV show, My Big Fat Fabulous Life, which, you know, I don't know, I'm in my 40s. So how many people in their 40s can say they
to be on awesome.
A reality TV show? I'm writing a book about non-diet nutrition. So I'm into some kind of fun things right now. But yeah, it's been a fun last 20 years, you know, doing this kind of nutrition thing from a different perspective than I was really expecting.
Wow. So yeah, like you said, twists and turns, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as you were talking, I think what came to my mind was so much of the emphasis in the medical field on losing weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know that's not a surprise probably to anyone listening, and it's not a surprise to me either, but I'm just wondering for you as a nutritionist, like, was that really your initial training was when people came into your office, that was kind of the goal, especially for the kids? Was that more of what you, the aim was, the goal? Because you said, I felt like I was failing. Like, did you ever get kids in or people in for any other reason? Like, was that kind of like the, oh, we reached our goal, this was quote unquote successful, if that occurred?
Mm-hmm. It depended on which clinic I was in. Certainly in pediatrics, there's lots of subspecialists in genetics or GI, where we had other kind of things we were working on that were outside of weight change. But I think so many in the medical field, like if you're trained in that way, weight and health are the same thing. They're synonyms. So if weight wasn't changing, then health wasn't changing. Like that was the assumption. So it was kind of unchecked in a way, right? So if someone I was seeing in the pediatric endocrinology clinic with high cholesterol and high blood sugar, if their blood sugar was improving or their cholesterol was improving, but their weight wasn't going down, then it was not considered a positive step forward, which is really frustrating, right? I see all that now, but that was just what I was trained to do and what I was assuming was the only way forward. It was also what I was, again, what I was told to do, you know, by those who were over me in the department. But yeah, and I think that's a big thing probably for you and me is the moment when we were able to tease apart weight and health. And now that we have done that, which I'm assuming some listeners have too, like once you tease those apart, you can't. Like it's so obvious how harmful it is to just assume that they're together. Like you're missing the health by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's I love that you said that, right? Because they are like they're synonymous. I hear that all the time, and I know I've said it on here on, you know, with other guests and myself on the podcast. Like it's just kind of this myth. I don't know that people believe in or buy in. It's almost like it's fact. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't challenge it. It's like, oh, if somebody's in a larger body, they must be unhealthy. And if they're in a smaller body, they must be healthy. And, you know, excuse me, audience, for those who've listened to me before say this, but the toxic diet culture message just perpetuates that. Right. And, yeah, how do we get out from under this? Because if it's so like pushed on us and social media in the medical field, people, I'm assuming people are still trained and working in nutrition in the medical field with that as like kind of the goalposts, you know, what do we do? Because I know we can only say so much, you and I, and we're only doing so much work, right? So what do we do?
Yeah. Cause it's not an individual, it's not going to change it, but definitely coming together, we can. And part of the individual work I know as a clinician is if you are hearing clients tell you certain things, like I heard the same thing over and over again, where people were trying to eat less and trying to move their body more, and it wasn't moving the needle and people were just feeling ashamed of it. Like they were doing it wrong. But in reality, like after 20 or 30 people tell you the same thing, there has to be something to it. And that's where I see many people who are still in the like push for weight loss. They're not able to take that leap over of like, oh, wait, maybe it's not working. Maybe we should stop pushing it. And, you know, I think it takes a lot of sitting with that, some murky things. That's why when I told you, it took me a good year to like really change directions. I had to sit with some really uncomfortable things, like my own belief system. And I mean, I went to school for like 6 years to learn how to do this. And I basically had to sit with like, maybe all these people I looked up to and paid money to were wrong. Not that necessarily that I know the right way, but I know this isn't working. And then the other thing I would say too is to listen to folks who say that they're being harmed by weight loss pushes. People who have that lived experience, like that's what I wish we learned more about. I know in my own training in dietetics, if you look at most dietitians and take a survey of our field, it's a very similar looking person doing the job. And I don't think that's just by accident. I think it's because how hard it is to be different in nutrition and have a different lived experience. And I think there's some structural issues to help change those who are helping. But then, yeah, like also let's listen to people who have been harmed by weight bias and, do our own individual work to change that. So I hope that answers your question, but.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's such a big monster, right? To tackle.
It's a big monster. Yeah. The other thing I want to add too is that I do think it's getting better in training programs because I do have my hands in a little bit in the nutrition training world. And now like where I did my internship, it's a whole weight inclusive internship. It's not, you can't leave that internship without training in eating disorders and weight bias and all the systems of oppression. Like you just can't. And it's not necessarily that is the norm, but there are more of those. And I think also social media has helped people who are learning to do different health fields, like seeing other options. So people are asking questions in these like lower undergraduate like science classes about this. And I think it's just going to it's going to break some more barriers down. Like the more people are finding this out early on, they don't have to do all that work after they're done and harming all these people as a clinician, there's going to be more people ready, from the get-go.
Well, that's encouraging to hear actually. Yeah. So that's nice. And I'm actually curious too. So speaking of social media, like you said, you were involved with a show and I'm wondering, but I don't know what your involvement was. Excuse me. I haven't watched it, but
That's okay. It was a long time ago.
did you find that the messaging in the show or what you were involved with like that was kind of helpful in terms of like countering some of the toxic diet culture messages that are out there?
It's a mixed bag. So yeah, this was in 2015 or 2016. So it's been a while. And something that I can say is I didn't necessarily want to be on TV. I'm not someone who's like ever really sought that out as part of my career. I really love doing one-on-one work and podcasting. That's totally fits me. But I also started to think about like, okay, if I don't do this, who are they going to pick in my town? And I was really worried about the diet messaging that was going to be heard. And I live in a really small town. So there's not very many dietitians that could have been doing this role. So we kind of all know each other. And so I was like, okay, I need to do this. This is not about me. I need to get over my anxiety and stage fright and just go do this. And I'm glad I did because the feedback I got for the most part, not everyone, was this is the first time I've heard this as an option, meaning I don't have to lose weight. One of the things I said on the show was like, weight loss is not a behavior, just some things that as dietitians and clinicians who are anti-diet, we say all the time, there are no good or bad foods, you don't have to cut out anything. There's many different ways to pursue health. These were all things that people were like, I'm so glad that you said this because I didn't know it was an option. There were clinicians who were like, I'm so glad that you showed that this is something that we can do. Yeah, so the feedback was mostly positive. Did it change the outcome of the show? No, because there were still like pushes for weight loss. But that's also like the person who's the main person on the show, Whitney Thor, she's a higher weight woman with PCOS. And so when a person is in a higher weight body, like there's going to be constant pressure to lose weight. So I don't necessarily think they were like misrepresenting. It's really actually representative probably as of what her days actually are like. But did it change it? No, but I don't even know if that was even an option at that point. I'm just glad that she was willing to film with someone who could discuss food in this way mm-hmm. and share her lived experience. So then, you know, the thing that I know you and I know is when someone feels isolated with these food experiences and these body experiences, it breeds so much shame. So mm-hmm. by her sharing this, it did a lot to help people to feel less alone, you know, and that's the thing that I know she gets the most feedback on is like, thank you for putting yourself out there. So then I don't feel like I don't feel as isolated or alone. Yeah.
No, that's true. And I don't know about you, but that's one reason I do this podcast is to get people to talk about their real life experiences and the dirty little secrets in your head, you know, with the end thoughts, right?
Yes.
Awful, right?
Yes.
Gosh, I wish I would have had somebody tell me all that when I was going through it, right? Because I thought, oh gosh, I don't want to tell anyone what's going on in here, what I'm doing in my personal mm-hmm. life. Like it was embarrassing, right?
Well, I love how you said dirty little secrets too, because people often think that they are these little secret things, that they're the only one that they perform in this way or think about food in this way. And everyone has their own unique lived experience, but there are definitely things that like so many people do that they have in common that they would just be, their mind would be blown to know like how similar someone else is experiencing the same thing. I always say that to my clients. I would be like, if you could just be a fly on the wall and it could still be HIPAA compliant, so you could hear what everybody else is saying, because you would feel so normal. This is not like, and not normal and like, oh, this is like a safe thing, but just like you are not this weirdo, you know, this is something that so many people are experiencing. Yeah.
Right. Cause I think that's the hard part for a lot of people who, you know, have an eating disorder. They just think, I don't have enough willpower. I'm not, you know, not trying hard enough. You know, I'm just failing at this. And then, you know, I love it too, right? I run groups and I just love that look on someone's face when they hear somebody say something and they're like, oh, you yes. too? Are you? Oh my gosh. I thought I was the only one that did that or thought that. And it's just this moment of like, almost like relief, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A special moment. That is a really great moment to witness. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's how I think people know that's the eating disorder. That's what I call ID, right? Mm-hmm. That's not just anyone listening. If you've ever heard anybody talk about an eating disorder behavior and you've had that moment where you go, oh, like that's not you're failing at dieting or lacking willpower. That's actually like, yeah, that's something to think about. Do I have disordered eating, an eating disorder? Like maybe this is something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the powerful part of being able to like take a step back and see the patterns with other people within yourselves to know that, yeah, this is something that you can rewire. This is something that you can recover from. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you were saying that the lead character had PCOS as well. And I know you've worked with many people mm-hmm. in the past who have PCOS. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is there some relief for somebody when they find out that they have PCOS? Like, oh, this explains a lot?
Yeah, 100%. I was just talking to a friend's daughter the other day who just got diagnosed. Because I don't work with people one-on-one anymore, so I don't have this as often. But many people talk about experiencing all these things and just feeling chaotic and like something's wrong with me. And my friend's daughter's, how old is she? 18 or 19. She was like, it was just such a relief to like know that there's a name for this and it's not all in my head. And mm-hmm. PCOS, like many conditions, especially a condition that is living in misogyny, you know, like it's invisible in many ways. And because it has to do with the ovaries, a lot of the times, I think it's just misunderstood and neglected in research. So yeah, it can just feel like you're making it up instead of actually experiencing something really hard. And you're not making it up for sure. There are like definitely pockets of things that people experience that are really common in PCOS. And so yeah, naming it is really powerful. And then also taking a step forward, like learning actually what PCOS is in your body, I think is something that's often neglected in the diagnostic process of like, okay, you know, it starts in your brain and it causes these hormonal kind of shifts and can result in these symptoms. And to know that like, if it changes, that's normal. As we get older, PCOS is something that's going to be different. And just to let people know, like, hey, this is what's going on in your body. I think also is like equally important in this kind of conversation of like getting that diagnosis, but then also learning what that diagnosis means. Mm-hmm. Instead of like, oh, we don't really have anything for you, but besides birth control, come back when you try to get pregnant. Cause that's, you know, really all. Oh, and lose weight. Yeah. Don't forget that one.
Maybe, you know, and I was just thinking, you know, people may hear PCOS and say, what on earth is that? So like, mm-hmm. I mean, you and I know what that is, right? And many people might know, but you know, it's polycystic ovarian syndrome. And mm-hmm. Even to that point, like you were saying, all these symptoms, like if someone's going, well, how would I know if I have this? Like, you know, what are some of the big symptoms people might, you know, who are listening might go, oh, I have these.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad that you asked that because you know, someone's going to listen and they're going to take it to their doctor and be like, I think I have this. So PCOS has technically like three different criteria that can be named. And if you meet two out of the three criteria, you can get diagnosed with it. So we'll go through that first, but there's also some like similarities that we should probably also name. But one, the first kind of criteria is irregular absent ovulation. So if you are someone who just never knows when you're going to get your period, or you never get it, or if when you do, they're super heavy and painful, that can also be a sign that there's something going on with your ovulation. And then the second one is signs, either through like lab work or just like by clinically observing you, of hyperandrogenism, so higher testosterone. So that can be like more facial hair on your face. Androgenic alopecia, or like the hair loss on your head, could be just more hair in general in places that you're not expecting. And then the last one is evidence of multiple immature follicles on ultrasound. And those are unfortunately also called cysts in like popular literature, but they're not actually cysts. But that's where the name polycystic ovarian syndrome comes from, is these like multiple cysts. But they're actually immature follicles. And keep in mind that you don't have to have those on ultrasound in order to get diagnosed with it. So like people can have this PCOS and not have polycystic ovaries, mm-hmm. which I always think is really interesting. So that's like the clinical kind of diagnostic stuff. But if you are someone who has a lot of trouble sleeping, or you have lots of fatigue, especially like painful fatigue, which if you have painful fatigue, you know what I'm talking about. It's like, it's not just like, oh, I'm a little tired. It's just like, it hurts because I'm so tired. If you have intense carb cravings, that's certainly as a dietitian, that's something that I would hear all the time, are like these like primal intense cravings for carbs, for sugar. And then after eating them, a lot of people would say there maybe it would be like a minute or two of feeling like satisfied or like that hit the spot. But then after that, it would feel pretty sluggish and maybe have a headache. And that has to do for a lot of people with PCOS have high circulating insulin. And so that can kind of make these cravings intense. But at the same time, you're told to cut them all out, and cutting out the very thing that your body's telling you you need or you're going to die, I just think is a particular level of torture. let's see. Many people with PCOS often have some sort of mood disorder before they start puberty. That can be for many people like their first kind of clinical sign. There's also, let's see, low vitamin D levels, thyroid issues. What else am I missing? There's
the acne here.
Acne. Oh yeah. Thank you. So like some people may have, instead of facial hair, they may have like really painful acne. Mm-hmm. Or cystic acne. And yeah, so for some people, that's like the way that they know they have higher androgens. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, I'm speaking from my experience, like I've shared with people, I have PCOS, right? So mm-hmm. All the things you're saying, I'm like, yes.
Yes. Check, check, check.
I just remember there was like one book that was like the PCOS diet. And yes, to your point, it was like eat low carb, high fiber. Like it was just this nasty thing that was like, oh, it sounds awful. But that was all there was back then. And it was
not much different now. I mean, it's not like we have this, like we do on like social media, but there's not like there's all these books to choose from that give mm-hmm. other options. It is like, I'm writing a book that's like not necessarily focused on PCOS right now, but I do include some things about PCOS in there. But I will write a book for PCOS at some point. Like I have to, like before I die, that is coming out. because there needs to be more options. Or, and anybody else who maybe want to write it, please, we need these books. Because yeah, like you don't need to cut out the very thing that your body is craving. And I think that's a really harmful part of PCOS management, is that there's this expectation that you should distrust your body because it's not telling you the right thing. Do what this clinician is saying, who probably doesn't have PCOS, probably doesn't even have a uterus. Cannot relate at all. And yeah, just do what they're saying and then you'll have the outcome. In reality, that's what I was so impressed with, is that so many folks with PCOS were doing what their doctors were telling them. And it was just, if it didn't cause a really intense, all-consuming eating disorder, it was making them feel awful physically and emotionally. So I do think that's a big problem. And that would be the other thing I would add to like the list of like signs that you could have PCOS, is if you do have an eating disorder or someone said that you have some disorder eating, I would rule out PCOS. It's so easy just to do that because it's just so common to see them together. And I say that because there's so many folks who came to see me because of their eating disorder. And then as I was talking to them, I was like, huh, they may have PCOS. Like I would just think that in my head. Mm. And if they did get that diagnosis, like having that information helped recovery so much, because then there's tools you can add that can help like reconnect with food and body and just repair all of that muck that healthcare and chronic illness kind of just got in the way, you know?
Yeah. I was actually wondering that too. Like, what do you think? I mean, I can speak from my own experience, but why do you think it's so prevalent for people who have PCOS to also have the eating disorder? Do you think it's because they're trying so hard to follow this like rigid diet or way of eating that they're told to eat? Or do you think it comes before that?
I think that people with PCOS, with the way that like the endocrine system is dysregulating hormones, it's kind of setting the stage. And how healthcare treats people with PCOS along with diet culture just sends this kind of expedited experience to go into an eating disorder. I think people without PCOS can experience the same thing. I just think it's a faster track with PCOS, because if the body has high insulin levels, high androgens, there's already going to be these cravings that just feel different than people without PCOS. And that kind of magnetic kind of pull to eat and feeling that kind of quote, out of control feeling with food, to kind of tip into that area. But then when you're also told, oh, you can't eat those. Oh, that's bad to eat that. Oh, you need to weigh less, to feel that pressure, it just turns the dial up even more. And I think if there wasn't diet culture, I think very few people with PCOS would have an eating disorder. Diet culture, I mean, if we could take away that, I mean, I guess there would still be eating disorders, but it would be so much easier to recover from. And I would even say, excuse me, if weight loss wasn't the treatment for PCOS, that's probably what I would mean more than anything, then I think people with PCOS, it would just be the same as everybody else. They would experience eating disorders probably at the same rate. But yeah, I think it's just like this perfect storm to get there, to get to the point where there's an eating disorder happening.
So I love that you said it that way. Right. Almost like, did they deem like treatment or management of the illness like successful if people lost weight versus anything else, like if their hormone levels are regulated or they were like, what did you experience? Did you experience that was like, oh yes, you successfully managing this because you've lost weight? Was that the only like thing they looked at?
Like, yeah, it just depends on how fat phobic the doctor is or the healthcare provider, right? So there are, in my like small town that I live in, when I was seeing clients, there were some doctors that once I saw clients having normal cycles and they were feeling so much more energized and like lab work was improving, they were like, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. And they would just send me more and more clients. And then there would be other doctors, like there's a few in particular that are popping in my brain right now, who were just like really triggered that I was not pushing weight loss, even though I would like all these other things were improving. And I need a name too. You don't have to work on all those other things. Like managing a chronic illness, like there's so many parts to managing it and living with one. Like you don't owe anybody like normal, like lipid values or blood sugar or anything. And whenever people would have those things, there were some doctors who just would double down and be like, I think what you're teaching them is crap. And I think you need to just like, I was really advocating for clients, especially when they were in the throes of an eating disorder, like binge eating disorder. And then their doctor was telling them to cut out carbs and sugar. And I'm like, hey, if you would like them to binge less, here's a hot tip. Telling them that they have to limit it is going to make the binging worse. I mean, that's just like, it takes about 10 minutes working in the eating disorder field to notice that. But no, people would just be like, no, because of the higher weight, it's just too bad, basically. And that to me just shows how much, how the lack of like humanity in healthcare and yeah, like how much of a block fat phobia is from some medical providers from being just like able to see the whole picture. And they're, again, like I said earlier, they're missing the health part of it, you know, the physical health and the mental health part of a person. And I do think it hurts people with PCOS more than everybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, because of that perfect storm with the hormone differences, it just sets people up to experience a really hard to treat eating disorder. And there's a lot of work to be done to fix that.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you put in the mental health part too, because, you know, like in what I do, you know, and especially how I felt, you know, I was told, oh my gosh, you're not going to be able to have children. And like for someone with an eating disorder that's already feeling like I need to control everything, I feel out of control, right? Because that's part of the eating disorder. This is one more thing that's huge for some women, right? Mm-hmm. To be told, oh, not only is your body out of control, but oh, your fertility is now something you can't control. And you may not, well, what I was told back in the day was you're not going to have kids. Right. Mm-hmm. I think the message hopefully is not that anymore, right. But it's so scary, right?
It is really scary. Yeah. I think the way the messaging from what I'm hearing now is there's a lot of like, well, why should we tell people if we don't really have a way to help? So even people not told that they even have PCOS or something similar to that, because doctors are like, well, we don't really have an intervention. And we can just help them lose weight anyway. So what's almost like you can't handle the hard things. And that makes me so angry.
Well, that makes me so mad. That's horrible. But yeah.
It's like the opposite of what you experience, but equally bad, you know? Right. Like there's a many things in the middle here. Like, hey, I will support you in your fertility. You may have issues with fertility. We don't know the whole picture yet. But you need to know like that there could have been things that they said could have said to you that would have been probably something that helped you feel powerful in the situation, but also and aware without like just overwhelmed, you know? And yeah, unfortunately, I think for a lot of people, they find out by accident that they are diagnosed with PCOS. Like they like go on their MyChart and read in there from like a ultrasound or something like that.
Oh, you know,
isn't that just such a, like, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Yeah.
That's a big, a lot of information to find out on your own.
Mm-hmm. And why couldn't you be told that? Yeah.
But I'm glad you're talking about it because I have a feeling maybe some people are diagnosed with that who are listening and going, I don't even know what it really means. And maybe they don't have a good provider who's really sitting down talking to them. And, mm-hmm. you know, just to piggyback on that too, to make it even worse, I think you know, in someone who does happen to get pregnant too, if they do happen to have PCOS and are in a larger body, then there's that whole thing too about mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. the weight bias with pregnancy and mm-hmm. well, even fertility, right? If you go for fertility treatments, that's another push too. Even if you don't have PCOS, yes. but right. like lose weight, you know, like, or yes. we're not going to help you if you're in a certain body size and mm-hmm.
It's a really big problem, and it keeps most people I know with PCOS, if they're in a higher weight body, it keeps them from even going to accessing healthcare Mm-hmm. And how is that okay? You know, there people will be like, yeah, I haven't gone to the doctor in 10 years because I'm just trying to avoid the trauma of being told, oh, I don't have a blood pressure cuff for you. And yeah, so Laura Burns is a yoga teacher that I am lucky enough to be good friends with. And she's someone who has just given birth. She has PCOS. She's in a higher weight body. And she talks a lot about that stuff on her social media. And another, I don't know, do you know Judy Simon? She's a dietitian that is coming out with a book on like fat positive nutrition during fertility treatments. Yeah. So there's, that's why I'm like, I think that there's some tide turning. It's just not fast enough for you and me, probably. we're like, come on, hurry up. But, you know, there's more and more resources. And I think the more that people talk about it, the safer it is for more people to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like all those things you mentioned, yeah, with fertility is a really big issue and super discriminatory. You know, you should be able to like grow your family no matter what body size you are. And no, the science does not say that your body size is actually the problem. We have so much more on like gestational age, and yet they still do IVF cycles for people who are like 40 plus, mm-hmm. but yet there's a very clear drop point of like how, the likelihood of a pregnancy that goes to term, but yet they will tell people at a certain BMI that there's a cutoff when they don't have that same data. Yeah, I know.
So. Yeah, I don't understand that. Because I still hear it all the time and it just makes mm-hmm. my blood boil. Like, oh, I weigh too much to go through fertility treatment. They won't mm-hmm. see me. And I'm going, I just have this look of like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, who's telling you this? And I still hear this a lot. Quite frequently.
It's very common. Yeah.
Me off. So anyone listening, I don't know, what would you tell them? Like, if they hear that or they actually believe that.
Yeah, I'd say it's discriminatory. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not okay. And it's not their individual burden to change the system, but like we need to all come together for that person. And endocrinology, whether it's reproductive endocrinology or whatever kind of endocrinology, it's a big problem. The weight bias in that field is a really big problem. And there's a few endocrinologists, maybe you know a few too, that are safer, but mm-hmm. we probably just have like two or three between the two of us. Right? Golden, and we live on different coasts.
Golden people.
Yes, exactly. And I know people would go, I live on the East Coast, they'd go to the West Coast to see mm-hmm. an endocrinologist if it would be a safer office visit. Who can do that? You know, first of all, but then also like, that's how limited it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, anyone listening who knows one of those wonderful doctors, have them DM me. I would love to have them on the show to talk about like all of this, yes. Dispel the myths. Like, because yes. I think experts in the field do need to come out and talk about this to be mm-hmm. the louder voices for mm-hmm. the norm and what's being said out there. Because I think a lot of people just don't believe that. They're like, no, that's not true. Or right. I've been told this so many times. How's that possible? There's no doctor that will do this. And they just give up. And I don't think that's right. People don't give up, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we can talk after we stop recording. There's a couple of people that pop in my mind for you. Okay. yeah. And again, like in the medical training right now, there are people who are starting their medical training who are weight inclusive, maybe because of their own lived experience or because they just have like been on TikTok and like met, you know, have watched a couple people who are talking about this. And so things are going to change. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, it's just not fast enough.
So I know we're getting close to time, but I did want to bring up maybe a controversial topic. I don't know.
Ooh, I love it.
Speaking of this, but I know when I finally was fortunate enough to get pregnant with help, they did put me on metformin, which is mm-hmm. the drug for, you know, people who have diabetes to hopefully keep my pregnancy like stable and my hormones and whatnot. Mm-hmm. My fear is that now I hope, I don't know what you think. My hope is that with all this Ozempic and semaglutide mm-hmm. stuff, that they're not going to turn to that for people who have PCOS when they're pregnant, or to try to get them pregnant, because they seem to be prescribing it for everything under the sun, right? Yeah. They're finding ways, right? I don't know. This is the train wreck I see coming, right? As we're talking.
Yes. You and I have been around long enough to see the themes and patterns repeating itself. And so that's why we're holding our breath. Well, I'm happy to tell you some things that I think about GLP-1s and PCOS, if that would be helpful.
Sure.
I did do a whole podcast episode on it, and I don't have the notes in front of me, but like, so someone's like, I need more. I can give you the link to it, but well, GLP-1s in particular they're not safe during pregnancy. So, you know, people won't be put on like you were with metformin. Many people are being put on it before getting pregnant. And the thing about GLP-1s and like the, how they work, a lot of people talk about prediabetes and diabetes with GLP-1s, like the research. Like I can remember 20, 25 years ago, I was a diabetes educator. That was like the first thing I specialized in, and going to a conference and people were crying because they were talking about GLP-1s and how it was like something that was so promising. We were so excited. Most of the research on diabetes, in particular insulin resistance that comes with type 2 diabetes, GLP-1s help in so many different ways. With managing that condition, there's harm that can come from it, but like the benefits outweigh the risk. But when we decided, not you and me, when the medical community decided to call insulin resistance and impaired glucose tolerance, those two different things, to lump them together to call them prediabetes and not differentiate between the two anymore, GLP-1s have been first with diabetes, and now prediabetes, and now anybody who may be higher weight, because they are lumping those impaired glucose tolerance and insulin resistance together. And the reason why I get really pissed off about this is if you have impaired glucose tolerance that's leading you to diabetes, GLP-1s aren't going to do it for you. But if you have insulin resistance, most people with PCOS are going to have this. There may be something to it at the lower dose. At like the lowest dose. And this is what I was telling you before we were recording. Like, I wish that they being researchers and medical providers could tease apart the weight and health piece. But because if they did, they could see all the improvements that happen at the 0.5 or like, I don't know the exact dosage. I know there's different ones for different GLP-1s, but like at these lower doses, seeing how much improvement people are experiencing, not everyone, but for many people what they're experiencing. But because weight loss doesn't really start to happen until people are over one for a lot of them, they kind of miss all that. And then there's just like this rapid weight loss. What I am excited about is that lower dose as an option for PCOS. I think that's really great. But because of this rapid push for weight loss, what I'm also seeing is when people do start to experience this rapid weight loss, how many people are getting activated for the first time or reactivated in their eating disorder. And it's making relapses that are so pervasive and hard to treat that it's going to do way more harm than good for so many people. A lot of people don't lose weight on these GLP-1s too. They may have like healthcare improvements, but they don't lose any weight. So then there's like lots of shame that comes from that for many people. I think it's going to be a big old mess. And some people are going to have some really long-term damage. And again, I'm like, there may be this missed opportunity at this very low dose. It could be fabulous for many people, but I think it got messed up. People just got too into the weight loss part of it and it's going to ruin it. Yeah.
Well, that's what it's known as. That's what they're known as now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, who cares about the blood sugar
issue? Yeah. And again, like it, when it was first being marketed, it was kind of a last resort diabetes medication for a reason, because there is harm that happens from using it. There's a risk to taking it. Mm-hmm. And if someone has really hard to treat diabetes, it has really helped a lot of people, not everyone, but you know, for those it helps, it helps. But now those who can't get access to it because every Bravo celebrity is on it.
Right.
I mean, I am a sucker for Bravo. So, you know, it's helped me get through some hard times in my life. But I do get frustrated with like how they won't even admit that they're on it. So anyway, that's my GLP-1 like soapbox.
No, but I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, people have even asked me, like, was pre-diabetes even a diagnosis years ago? And is that a new thing? And like, what is this just a push for big pharma? Like,
yeah, that's basically it. Because the American Medical Association, they created this big committee to decide if it was worthy to call pre-diabetes like a thing. And there were so many conflicting things that happened. Same thing with even obesity as a disease. very similar outcomes to these committees. So, but yeah, the pre-diabetes thing is, I think it's like 5% of people with pre-diabetes end up having type 2 diabetes in the next like 10 years. You know, it's a very small percentage of folks. So,
yeah. Just seeking for psychological reasons, when I have patients who get that diagnosis of pre-diabetes, they're basically thinking, I have diabetes. Oh my gosh, I have to diet after this, after that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that can really trigger eating disorder stuff immediately.
Uh-huh. It's like exactly horrible. And that's so harmful. And honestly, if we are privileged enough to live to old age, we are all going to have blood sugar issues. And I say this partly from my own lived experience. Like I had four grandparents that three out of the four lived into their late 90s, all with diabetes. The one that died in his mid 80s also had diabetes, but he only lived to like 85. So, you know, my one that was 99 when he died, he had diabetes for his, like, since his like 50s.
Wow.
And, you know, we know so much about how to treat it. If you have access to healthcare, and consistent healthcare, and you live in a safe place, and you have access to food, your likelihood of having those scary things that we think about with diabetes is very rare. We really need to make sure people who don't have access to those things get what they need, so they don't have to worry about like gangrene and blindness and things like that. Don't let it be a fear. Instead, you know, let it like empower you to help your community. That's what I would hope everyone kind of feels instead. So, yeah.
I love that. It'd be great if we just normalize things.
Yes. Well, to throw some normalization there, I have prediabetes or whatever we're going to call it. So like, whatever. I'm like, my Duffy DNA, in my mid 40s, I was like, I think I can feel something different. Like I can tell something's going on with my insulin levels. And yeah, there it was. And so, yeah, knowing your medical history, if you have access to it, and to normalize, like maybe food is not going to be the cure all for these things. Like genetics is still the biggest part of experiencing diabetes.
My goodness. You have said so many wonderful things and helpful things and informative things. And, so if people do want to find you, they want to read your book, they want to find you on social media, how can they find you?
So my podcast is Find Your Food Voice. So just go search that in the search bar right now. And you can find the GLP-1 in there. And my website is julieduffydillon.com. I'm on TikTok. If you're over there, Food Voice RD is my handle. And yeah, stay in the loop. The book will be out in 2025. It'll be here before we know it, right?
Awesome. Fantastic. Good.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you again so much. Any last final words before we end?
No, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's an honor to be able to talk to your listeners. And yeah, I hope people can, I don't know, just feel more powerful with the knowledge that like they're not doing anything wrong, and their experiences, they're not alone in them. And the more we can kind of all open up about them, I think that, you know, the more chances for recovery.
Thank you again so much, Julie.
Yeah, thank you.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.